This is the forgetting.
And when you have that black cloud above you, can you say how long that lasts?
I'm going on about 3 days now.
Oh, so you're feeling that way right now. It's really yeah. quite strong in you right now.
Yeah, it is. We look at a blue wall, and someone with Alzheimer's says it's red, and you can't wait to correct them to tell them it's blue. Does it really matter whether it's blue or red? Does it matter more about the person? It's almost like your politics, you know. So when you go through something like this, you try to find the common ground in people and try to walk in love. I don't want to get out of bed in the morning. So what I do, my life is a strategy. I make appointments early in the morning, and I have my alarm clock go off and I put it on the other side of the room, so I have to get out of bed. And I got it to play Cat Stevens' song, Some Tea from the Tillerman, which I love. So at least I wake up in the good mood.
From WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and from the tip-top floor of my somewhat chilly brownstone in Brooklyn, New York, this is The Forgetting, a podcast about dementia. I'm David Shank, author of the book The Forgetting, and senior advisor to an international research consortium called Cure Alzheimer's Fund, which helps make this podcast possible. And with me, as always, is my friend and co-host, Greg O'Brien, author of On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. His book has that subtitle because Greg has early onset Alzheimer's, and he is committed to reporting his experience for as long as he possibly can. That's why this podcast exists. Hey, Greg, how are you?
I'm doing well, David. How you doing? Are you still smarter than me?
We're gonna hopefully find that out over the next half hour or so.
Okay, I'm still better looking than you. I have a good radio face.
You made it to the studio, so
got a little confused. I got flipped off as my son was driving me a few times because I was late, but I'm used to that, right? I just think of them as hand gestures, like puppets, you know? People are flipping me off now.
I think we can blame that on your son, though, can't we?
Well, we could, but I was doing the flipping off. I started it, kind of, you know?
Really?
I got it going.
We should probably start following you around with a video camera so we can have some of those
well, the police things, maybe my kids should, you know, the police, now they have those monitors that you know, the cameras that they have,
the body cams. Yes,
body cam. Yeah, my kids, and they should probably do that. They would find that funny.
Right. So I should tell everyone that this is episode number 7, and we're recording this on March 16th 2017. It's been about 6 weeks, Greg, since you and I spoke. I don't imagine there's been a lot of change, but how are you feeling generally, health-wise?
You know, I battle in the flu. What happens is that the body, my immune system is not good. And I might have talked about this before, and if I did, you guys could edit it out. But I went to the doctor, and basically they said, no shit, Greg. I better say it again in case I can't say shit. I could say shit.
You can say it.
Okay, all right. It's like a little kid. I'm becoming more childlike now, which is kind of good. They said, you know, your body's, you know, you're fighting Alzheimer's and cancer and spinal stenosis and scoliosis and depression, and no shit, your immune system's in the toilet. So not feeling that well. And then you asked a question, I'm going to answer it, and then I got to respond with something. For people who are listening, just to try to give them a sense of the fight, the black hole depression's pulling me in more. Mm. And I've had a few people talk to me recently over the weekend, and I'll read to you. I wrote, sometimes you just reach out. It wasn't a threat, but good friends of mine, Paul and Leslie Durgan in Milton outside Boston. And I had sent them an email and I said, in the depths of depression, I'm reading from it right here. I can't wait to leave this planet. I'm kind of done. That's off the record, okay. So much for that, I guess I'm telling everyone. But today marks 5 years since I've seen my cancer doctor. As body and mind functions continue to shut down, have been looking pretty good these days. And which is cool about it, and you know, I hate cliches like it takes a village. I got calls from them instantly, and it wasn't a threat, but it's you just it beats the shit out of you, and it's not me, it's everyone, and maybe by talking about it, it gives others encouragement to say, okay, we're all going through it, so let's rise up. What's that great song by Bruce Springsteen? You know, let's rise up.
Rise up,
So I need people to help me rise up, and I'm trying now, knowing that, to help other people rise up.
So
it's a great song, by the way. I love that Springsteen song.
My City of Ruins is the song you're thinking of.
Okay.
And when you have that black cloud above you, can you say how long that lasts?
I'm going on about 3 days now.
Oh, so you're feeling that way right now. It's really quite strong in you right now.
Yeah, it is. And I was talking to someone today and they could tell. They said, how you doing? It was a nurse, a neurological nurse. She said, you're not doing well, are you? And, you know, we talked about this. And again, it's not a threat. It's just trying to figure it out. And so you say, wouldn't it be easy? I have, like I said before, a strong faith, imperfect guy. Sometimes you say, wouldn't it be easier if I just went and saw my parents?
Mm.
They ain't here, by the way. They're that's a long distance call.
Right.
So,
indeed. Let me ask you a couple of kind of naive questions.
But just to give you which I think is important. I wrote a piece about it once in Huffington Post called "The Black Dog," when Robin Williams died, and he suffered from depression and also apparently appears forms of dementia along those lines, you can't judge people on the surface. So people would see Robin Williams and they go, oh, what a funny guy, you know, but, you know, or you would do a drive-by with me. And we got to pull together what we're, you know, I don't want to get on a soapbox, but all we're doing is kicking the crap out of everyone, you know, and, you know, we need more manly and womanly hugs and, you know. Hey, I have my strong opinions on things, but as I go through this journey, I become less judgmental and try to find that common ground. And we don't seem to find that as much these days.
And can I take it that the depression feels harder to overcome with the dementia?
I've noticed that it people can Google it. You know, my favorite line, I cut up a frog in high school, but I had clinical depression as a kid, but Alzheimer's or dementia will bring it on more. And I think, you know, I've had two serious head injuries, which also exacerbate things. And sometimes I'm finding now I don't want to get out of bed in the morning. So what I do, my life is a strategy. I make appointments early in the morning. And, you know, I have my alarm clock go off and I put it on the other side of the room. So I have to get out of bed and I got it to play, Cat Stevens, songs from Tea from the Tillerman, which I love. So at least I wake up in the good mood Tea from the Tillerman's pretty good, but I need to stay focused. Right, David? And then I have things I plan every day, but there are days when I just want to go out to Pluto.
So what got you out of bed this morning besides Cat Stevens? Was it
having to talk to you?
Because
I knew you'd be bitching at me.
Oh, it's not excitement to talk to me. It's fear. Oh, no, I'm not showing up.
My filter. What I meant to say was it was such an honor that I was afraid. I had to take my shoes off as I walked across the room, you know, in case your spirit was present.
Yeah, I'm so vain that I will extract a change in rhetoric from a man with dementia and depression when he says that it's when he says it one way and I want to hear it another way. That's okay. That's how vain I am.
All right. Well,
and we've got that on the record now.
He who has an ear, let him hear. That's from the Book of Revelations, by the way.
But I really hear what you're saying about your earlier point about not judging other people, and that's long been something that I've just been very just deeply interested in, and I've had a few illnesses come my way as well, and I think most people have once they get to a certain age, and it's really striking. I think about it often in physical terms. Living in New York City, I get going around the city, and you just see, you know, just going down the block, you'll walk past, you know, dozens of people sometimes. So there's just a lot of people here, and when you're walking around the city and you're not well, you're not at your prime. They're just little things that you can't do, and you realize that everyone watching you doesn't see what you can't do, and they assume that you're feeling just like them. And I know that because I assume that when I'm feeling well, I look at others. It's really hard to have that empathy, even having learned this lesson, is what I'm trying to say. And I think you're exactly right that the antidote to that is just constant reminders to people that not everyone is feeling as well as you are in this moment, and there's all sorts of challenges. And so when someone does something that just it doesn't seem optimal to you, don't rush to judge them. You don't know what their day was like. You don't know what they're feeling like. You don't know what their upbringing was like. You don't know what their education was like. You don't know what's in their bank account. I mean, there's so many things obviously that can push a person down.
Where are my wife and I at some point will face bankruptcy. My favorite line, I may have used it, but one of my favorite lines is, we have plenty of cash, it's just tied up in debt. And but what, there's a blessing with disease, whether and I don't want to upset anyone by saying this who's walking through certain things, because everyone's journey is different, but let's just say for me, as I said before, you become less judgmental. We can't wait until someone finishes a sentence to tell them that they're wrong, or their politics sucks, or their religion sucks, or whatever it is, their opinion sucks. And when you have a disease, you know, whether it's Alzheimer's or cancer or AIDS or heart, whatever it is, autism, you realize there are far more important things than someone's opinion, which is just that, is the old saying, everyone's entitled to an opinion, but not their own set of facts. And so I think what happens is people in disease, ironically, may have turned the corner in a lot of ways on judging people and look more for the common ground than those people who are feeling good. And I don't know if that resonates with other people who are going through stuff, but, you know, I once told, I have a note here, when I gave a speech and people said, well, what happens in Alzheimer's? And I say, well, sometimes, many times you don't see it right. So let's keep it simple. So we look at a blue wall, and someone with Alzheimer's says it's red, and you can't wait to correct them to tell them it's blue. Does it really matter whether it's blue or red? Does it matter more about the person? It's almost like your politics, you know. So when you go through something like this, you try to find the common ground in people and try to walk in love. And I'm the most, you know this, I'm one of the most imperfect people in the world. But you learn, and that's part of the journey. The journey is not all bad. if you have ears to listen.
Yeah, that really resonates with me, and I think you just put your finger on...
Did I give you the finger again?
Yeah, I think you just put your finger on why I wonder this about myself, but you know, my book about Alzheimer's came out a long time ago. It's been 15 or 16 years, and so what am I still doing? You know, fascinated by this subject, and
Mary Catherine's favorite books, by the way. So I'm giving you a plug.
Well, that you've already said, so we'll edit that out. But it's very kind of you again.
You won't edit that out, but
please keep saying it every time, and we'll say that we're editing it out, and we never will. But my serious point is that, you know, what am I doing here? Why am I so drawn to this subject, aside from now just being so close to you and wanting to do this particular project? But the thing about it is, more globally, is that there's something special about being in this world with the scientists, with the doctors, with the patients, with the caregivers, with the advocates. And it's what you just talked about. It's everyone gets past the bullshit of just judging everyone else when you're in this world where you're dealing with this really, really challenging illness. And people don't judge one another. They just have this layer, this kind of starting point of kindness that's the jumping off point of every conversation. And it's very unjudgmental. And that's why people say to me when I'm giving talks about Alzheimer's, after I've, you know, gone on for 10 or 15 minutes about the nasty stuff, of which there's plenty, people will remind me that actually it's also one of those phenomena that brings people closer together, brings friends and family and strangers close together in a really special way. And I know it's brought you and me closer together. So, and I think you put your finger on why. I think it's that lack of judgment. I think it's getting past the way we ordinarily just, for some reason, instinctively judge one another.
David, that's actually a wonderful transition into our guest. Would you like to introduce our guest?
I will. And here's my surprise for today, Greg.
I thought I was the guest.
No, you're not. You're the co-host, man. You'll never be called the guest. You and I are co-hosts of this thing, and that's the way it's always going to be. But our special guest today is someone who you know quite well, and I wanted to kind of pop this on you as a fun surprise. It's your good buddy, Lisa Genova.
Oh, my God. Lisa, is that you?
Hi, Lisa. Yes.
It's the only way.
Greg.
It's the only way we can connect. This is like, this is like I Dream of Jeannie, you know?
She just pops into your life.
But if I was granted three wishes, I'd have to go to the confessional. So I have to keep it good. So.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, we were emailing and texting yesterday, and I had to keep myself from ruining the surprise. So yeah, it's good to chat with you. It's been a while.
God love you. How you doing?
Let me pause this before we get into the fun stuff and tell the world. I mean, everyone knows who Lisa Genova is, but let me do it formally anyway and say that, Lisa, you're a best-selling writer of four terrific books, and they're all, in one way or another, about brain impairment, really. And one of them was what's called Still Alice, and it was made into a lovely movie. And that one was about Alzheimer's disease. And at some point you became close friends with Greg, and you both live in the same area. Your newest book is called Inside the O'Briens. Let's give that a plug. And it's about Huntington's disease. And one of the things that makes you so special, and then I'll stop the formal stuff, is that, and people may not know this, even though they probably know about your books, is that you are not only a wonderful writer, but you are trained as a scientist, as a neuroscientist, in fact. In fact, one of the ironies is that you were trained, I believe, with Rudy Tanzi, our guru over at Cure Alzheimer's Fund. So you know him real well also. But you have, as this incredible niche in your writing, you have made it this extraordinary career of writing about not just the brain, all these different fascinating brain diseases, but in a rich and full way, with all these characters that you explore in fiction. Thank you for being here.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much.
Lisa, tell them about your new book. I'm putting a plug in for that right now.
the new book is called Diminuendo, and it's about ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, and that will be out early next year. But yeah, with all of the books I write, it's, you know, it's such a different world. You're talking about the world that you're in, David, with the scientists and the doctors and the patients. You know, I used to wear the white lab coat and hang around rats and mice and pipettes and DNA all day, which is, you know, thank God Rudy Tanzi does what he does. And this thing I've chosen to do, which is to write stories about people living with neurological diseases and disorders, is to really sort of get people to understand the human experience of living these diseases and walking these shoes, and to get rid of some of the misconceptions and the stigma and the shame and the sort of alienation and loneliness that can tend to piggyback on a lot of these diseases. And so this is, you know, Greg and I became friends through his Alzheimer's, and, you know, it's such a very strange gift to, like, I don't know if I'd know you, Greg, without you having Alzheimer's, which is bizarre to think of.
I'm actually a kind of a nice guy.
Yeah, we would have met anyway.
All right.
But yeah, I mean, Greg is out there, and his mission is to sort of, like, to put a real face and voice on this disease so that it's not this terrifying boogeyman that people can turn their heads away from and pretend doesn't exist, and to really sort of drop the preconceptions and the judgments that might keep people with Alzheimer's excluded from community and separate from everyone, and to really bring them back in and see how we can live as well as possible with this disease.
Lisa, I want to know how you, since your books are so widely read now, and you interact with, you have a real public, and so you must hear back from people constantly. And I wonder what some of those themes are. What stands out, or what surprises you about how people are responding to this unique way that you're writing?
I'd say sort of the common thread between all of the books, because I've written about autism and brain injury and Huntington's, like you mentioned. And I think it's just the appreciation of being seen and heard. I think that, you know, people tend to feel like they're walking this path alone, or that they aren't understood, or that they don't matter anymore. You can sort of be written off once you are diagnosed with these various diseases. And I think that seeing some of your own experience portrayed in a story, that you can recognize yourself and recognize that you're not alone in it. So that's incredibly rewarding to hear from people. And also part of what I hope to achieve with the books is to, so it begins with sort of this compassionate awareness and empathy for the human experience. And then it's like, well, what can I do? How can I get involved? How can I help? In the absence of a cure, what resources do people need? And how can we be part of the cure? Because at some point we will have a preventative medicine for Alzheimer's, and which is essentially a cure. And, you know, how can we be a part of that progress now? How can we play in that arena and not just be a spectator in the stands? Like, how can I help be part of this historic mission?
Plus, to do that, you have to be an extraordinary writer, which you are. When did you realize, was it grammar school where you realized you had a touch for writing, Lisa, or
no,
love Greg, letters to boyfriends, or what was,
well,
it?
Clearly, no, that hasn't gone well at all. You've been writing forever. Greg is a gorgeous writer. I mean, you've been plugging my books. I assume we've been talking about On Pluto, and what an absolutely extraordinary book and resource that is for anyone walking this journey. No, I was a geeky scientist. I was all about biology and the brain. And like David said, I was in lab at the neuroscience program at Harvard, at Mass General East, down the hall from Rudy Tanzi. The writing thing came, it was a happy, strange accident. It was, you know, my grandmother had Alzheimer's, and trying to understand her disease from reading what was out there at the time, left me with this burning question still, which was, what does it feel like to have this? And having been a lifelong reader of fiction, I thankfully made this very strange intuitive leap that, well, writing fiction would be a way to answer that question, because fiction is, when we read fiction, we walk in someone else's shoes. We have the chance at empathy.
Well, you do it very extraordinarily.
Oh, thank you, my friend.
I wonder, you know, a lot of fiction writers talk about the lonely part of writing, because they're all that imagination, just all that hard work of organizing the characters and the story, and it's, writing is a solitary experience for the most part. I wonder if your experience is a little bit different, because, as you said, now that you've experienced it a number of times, you know in advance that you are going to be helping real people connect with the outside world and vice versa, so you can kind of leap ahead with that feeling, and you kind of can feel that connection as you're creating it. Does that help with the lonely writing part?
You touched on it a bit. Yeah, there's a sense, there's an enormous sense of responsibility to get it right. And before I sit down and write the book, I spend many months knowing families who are affected. So I've just spent the last year in a lot of living rooms and assisted living centers of people living with ALS. And I know the doctors and the scientists in that field very well. And I'm in constant touch with them while writing the book, and it becomes very personal. So I already have a sense of, I want to make them proud, and I want to make sure that this represents the experience in an authentic way. It portrays it with dignity and in a way that's going to help people who don't know nothing about this feel it.
Well, the ALS book, from what I know from talking, is destined to be another bestseller. Again, it's that the ability to take a disease, in this case, where, and maybe you could describe the difference between, I know there's a clear difference, but between Alzheimer's and ALS, and the tragedy of ALS, as you've talked to me before about it.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of, you know, they're similar in some ways, and they're the inverse in other ways. So I chose ALS because Richard Glasser, who was one of the two guys who wrote the script for the movie Still Alice and then directed it, he was diagnosed with ALS just a couple of months before he read the book. And what I was in awe, one of the many things I was in awe of about him, is that here he was just diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disease with no treatment and no cure, and he's now agreeing to make a film about a neurodegenerative disease with no treatment and no cure. And so they're very different in that, you know, Richard's memory was totally intact, and, you know, his thinking, his cognition, language, and memory were fine, and with ALS, you become progressively paralyzed. So his started actually in his head, so he lost his voice almost immediately. I never heard the sound of his voice while he was alive. While he was on the set, he could still walk, but his left arm, I believe, was paralyzed, and his right hand, he could move one finger, and so he just co-directed that film with one finger on an iPad. By the time we were emailing about ALS, he was typing with his big toe. So you get increasingly locked in physically, and so the ability to reach people and communicate is one of the most terrifying things, but ultimately you can't breathe because your diaphragm is a muscle, and you lose the ability to use that. But interestingly, where it's similar, so the speech that Alice makes in Still Alice, which I was very proud of in the book, and it's one of the most celebrated passages in the book in terms of what people card out to use in speeches to motivate people and for advocacy, they changed it for the script and in the film. And at first, I was a little, you know, indignant and like, why would you change this speech? I'm so grateful they did. So Richard wrote the speech that's in the movie, and it was based on his experience with ALS that he wrote that. And so there's where the crossover is. It has to do with, you know, I'm still here and I still matter, and I want to live as richly and fully as I can, or as long as I can. And
well,
so
speaking
the,
of that,
that sense of it is the same.
Speaking of that, Lisa, one of the cliches, and tell me if this is true, but you know, with Alzheimer's, I think people who don't have a connection to the disease think that, well, once you'd get to a certain point, they would want to commit suicide because, you know, they wouldn't want to face that. But it's really, in practice, it's very difficult with Alzheimer's because once you get to the point where you wouldn't want to live anymore, you're not cognitively intact. That's the practical difficulty with Alzheimer's and suicide. Whereas with ALS, I believe it's pretty much, the reverse of that, and that you are cognitively intact, and you can make that decision. And so the cliche I at least have in my head is that there are a lot of people with ALS who kind of decide, okay, I'm at that point now, and they can make a intelligent and mature decision that they don't want to live anymore. Is there truth to that?
You know, what I've learned over the course of writing the book so far is none of this is black and white. I think everyone diagnosed with any of these contemplates their suicide, which is extraordinary because most people Greg's age don't think that way. But everyone who's diagnosed with Alzheimer's eventually thinks, like, when should I check out? Could I do that? Interestingly, more people consider it and commit suicide with Huntington's than any other. With ALS, ALS is so fast. It's shockingly fast. Huntington's goes for 10 to 20 years. ALS, I think the average is 3 years. A lot of the people I've met over the last year and a half, I mean, I can think of 3 funerals already. So it's by the time you even sort of register that I might want to do something like that in the future is upon you. I will say with ALS, there hospice is involved typically at the end. And so there's a way of sort of being sedated and on morphine when your breathing ceases. So it can be a very sort of peaceful, conscious exit. And then with Alzheimer's, you know, you don't drop off a cliff. And so one of the misconceptions is when you hear that someone has Alzheimer's, I think people immediately skip to the concept of end stage. And you imagine the person is dying of Alzheimer's. And so there can be a lot of time between diagnosis and end stage, or a stage in which you would say, well, I wouldn't want to be here at that point. And so, you know, human beings have a remarkable ability to adjust and adapt, and the resilience of the human spirit. You know, I think prior to diagnosis, Greg might have thought, you know, if my short-term memory is cut down to 30 seconds and I'm forgetting people's faces and I wake up in the morning and I look at the woman next to me and I don't recognize Mary Catherine as my wife, I don't want to be here if I'm like that. You might have thought that.
Which has actually happened twice
to
me.
I know. But, you know, there are so many strangely unexpected gifts that have come out of this. And, you know, Greg, I'm going to speak for you right here, and please feel free to correct me, but there are so many ways in which Greg's life is like remarkably rich and important in ways that it wasn't before he had Alzheimer's. I mean, he is making a heroic difference worldwide in how people hold this disease and really healing a lot of families who are out there trying to figure this out and don't have a roadmap. And Greg is offering a lot of hope in terms of like how to live and how to matter while you have this. So like this idea of, well, I'm going to commit suicide at a certain point when a disease reaches a certain point. It's not just that people with Alzheimer's might forget their plan like Alice did and still Alice. It's we adjust and come up with new ways of making our lives have meaning. And it doesn't have to rely on memory language and cognition. It can come from more of a heart space, which is, I think, what Greg has discovered and is sharing with people.
Well, you with a lot of disease too, you fight to get to the next day, and a lot of that fight, I think, in Alzheimer's, because you're not paralyzed, you could you could take a picture of me today, and even though I've aged, you could say it's the same guy. Someone who's paralyzed watching him, it's, you could tell that it's different. And but the fight to get through it, I was honored to give a speech in Switzerland to a lot of medical experts, and they were asking me, how would you feel about medication that can prolong the progression? And I looked at them and I said, don't do that. And they said, what? I said, find a way to stop it before it starts, because the progression is such that you have to go through such mechanizations of, if that's the right word, to get through the day, that it wears the crap out of you.
Yeah, it takes a lot of, well, you're so stubborn. Well, it takes a lot of tenacity.
The Irish.
But I'm of course grateful that you keep fighting every day, and we're all here to give you whatever you need to keep going for as long as you want to.
You've been a real encouragement, and for anyone's listening, Lisa's Mate on Pluto, a far better book and guidance she's given me on it. So it couldn't have been without her good help.
It's amazing that we've kind of had two separate conversations in this one episode, one before Lisa got here and one with Lisa, and they both ended up with Greg's purpose and the relationship of that to his willingness to go forward and how he kind of, resolves those two tensions. So Lisa, thank you so much for taking the time. We both know how busy you are.
One last question. Are you going to surprise me next time with my nun from the first grade, Sister Syra? Is that what we're doing here?
You never know.
Love you, Lisa. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lisa.
And
we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, bye guys.
See ya.
Bye. If you want to start thinking of this as a version of This Is Your Life, Greg, go ahead. Maybe sometimes the surprise will be that there's no surprise at all, but all right. If I can keep you on your toes.
Oh, you did today. Wow. Good job.
I figured it would be more fun. I know you are very close with Lisa, and the three of us have hung out together, and you do a lot of events with her. But so I thought the way to mix that up would be to not tell you that she was going to be on the program.
I feel bad about flipping all those people off in the car now.
That was also my purpose. I wanted you to end this episode feeling as guilty about your treatment of humanity as possible.
You know, they always talk about the Jewish guilt. I love the Jewish people. I do think that the Irish do pretty good when it comes to guilt. So,
yeah, we could definitely go toe to toe, us Jews and you Irish, in the guilt department.
Yeah,
I'll tell you some good stories about my Jewish grandmother.
Love to hear it
sometime. Well, that's all the time we have for today. So let me thank Greg again for making the trip and taking the time and for exposing his thoughts in the most candid way possible. I think you're giving a new sense of the definition of the word candid, Greg. So
well,
thank you for that.
You helped pull me out of my depression. So thank you.
Oh, that's a very high compliment indeed. And you know that I'm always there for you too, on or off the air, Greg. So give me a call if those other friends aren't answering you, and put me on your speed dial as well.
All right, love you, brother.
A few credits here before we say our complete goodbyes at WCAI in Woods Hole. The engineer is Dan Tridle. Thank you as always, Dan. The Forgetting is a production of WCAI. Our producer is the great Sean Corcoran. Our theme music was composed and produced by the aforementioned Dr. Rudy Tanzi, who is also chair of the research consortium at Cure Alzheimer's Fund. So everything comes full circle. Thank you, Rudy, as always. And Greg, last but not least, you still owe me $100. Please don't forget that.
I'm going to fax it to you, okay?
Okay.
All right, look for it.
Sounds like a deal.
All right. Love you.
Talk to you soon. Love you, man.
See you. Take care.
Yep. Yeah.